Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome back to the Salieri Report someone who needs no introduction here, and that's Dr. Joseph Farrell. He's here to talk with us about the annual wrap-up and what we see ahead for 2015. And I've just been a very immersive process working on the wrap-up, and it started with me stopping and seeing Joseph on my travels and talking about the big picture. And as you can see, Joseph, you had a great input, including inspiring us to do the money maps, which I can't thank you enough for doing that. It was very illuminating process.
Well, thanks for having me back on, Catherine. Pleasure to be here.
Okay, 2015. There's so much to talk about.
We talked about them last night.
Yeah, I thought we could start with what I call the, you know, I sent this to you when the new issue, the November-December issue of Foreign Affairs came out from the Council on Foreign Relations, and Richard Haass, the head of the Foreign Relations, had written an article called The Unraveling, and it sounded like somebody from KC Research saying, you know, the world is coming to an end, the world is coming, and he implied that the Bretton Woods system was now shifting into what he called the New World Disorder. So I wanted to kind of start with the unraveling, what that's all about, and the incredible development we see around the BRICS nations of starting to create all sorts of independent systems and capacity. So why don't we start there? What is the unraveling?
Well, like we said yesterday when we were talking before the show, it's we both kind of agree that we're looking at the very end. You know, this has been a long process with the unraveling of Bretton Woods. Nixon took us off the gold parity back in 1971, 72, I think it was. And it's been a slow process of unraveling since then, but now it's going full speed. And we both think, I think you were the one yesterday that brought this up, Catherine, that the BRICS nations, when we see them beginning to implement their own international financial clearing structures, parallel clearing structures, this is part of it, I think, and I think you would agree with that this is part of their scheme. But you had the observation, and I thought it was really a good one when we were talking yesterday, that this might be also kind of building the new system and building lots of redundancy into the system, not just reliant upon SWIFT and CHIPS in this country, but to have the BRICS nations with their own parallel international financial clearing structure. So that's definitely a sign right there, even if it's not part of some overall global arching agenda. Just the fact that they're doing it means that it's unraveling.
Right, but I think it also means that the new, if you look at where we're going in terms of a new financial system, it means we're going to get there faster.
Yep, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. They can't, what we've been seeing in the last 2 years, particularly the last year, it really accelerated last year. I was noticing all these stories, you probably did too, of the BRICS nations adopting these bilateral currency swap agreements. And in one or two cases, they were multilateral. I think there was a story about India, Russia, and Iran. And what this means is they're going to have their own structures for international financial clearing. And we saw last year a big step taken in that direction when Russia inaugurated its own internal domestic clearing system to get away from the Western systems. And the other story that we saw last year was Russia insisting and actually getting Visa to open up a Russian center in Russia.
Right.
So we're watching a lot of redundancy being built into the system. I think it's going to accelerate this year rather dramatically. I don't see China sitting this out much longer, and they're going to do some similar things to Russia, and they're probably going to integrate with whatever the Russians are doing. So I think it's going to accelerate this year.
One of the things, I do think there is a significant risk that we get a much stronger dollar this year. And if you are any of these countries, it it was clear last year that it was urgent you get into place ways of swapping currencies back and forth without going through the dollar.
Right.
Because if you, you know, the dollar's up sharply since June. If it continues, then trying to clear through the dollar is going to be absolutely...
It's going to be
Right. And so I think they see, you know, I describe it as a, it's a little bit misuse of the term, but I describe it as a bear trap, because if the, if you raise interest rates, you pull the leash, then you bring, you know, half the emerging markets to their knees. And the U.S. plays its trump card, and it's could be very ugly. So anything you can do to trade currency to currency outside the dollar is a lifesaver.
Yeah, we saw a little hint of that coming with last year with the story that I think it was South Korea and China had put in a one of those bilateral currency swaps to convert South Korean and Chinese currency directly to each other, bypassing the dollar. And like you say, that's going to accelerate the process. That's going to be a huge pressure on the BRICS nations to accelerate the process of developing international clearing. The thing that you've always emphasized, and I think that we have, it would be good to emphasize again, is you've emphasized that international financial clearing is so very dependent these days on space assets. So I suspect the other thing that we're going to see happen this year is there's going to be a huge push by the BRICS and nations, China, Russia in particular, but we're probably also going to see Brazil and India jump on the bandwagon and start talking about bilateral space agreements between those nations to beef up their space-based assets to put
believe it or not the
system.
The New Economist has an article about China, a new space program base they have in southern China, and talking about how China is making more knowledge accessible about their space programs and what they're doing in space.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is what you do if you want people to cooperate with you in doing these things.
Exactly, exactly.
Right.
I think this is going to expand. We're going to see similar stories. I can almost guarantee you that we're going to see similar stories coming out of India. I think an important country to watch here in this coming year as the Asian nations begin this process of building some redundancy into international clearing is going to be Japan. Japan has been pretty much thus far reliant on the West. I think we're going to see them step forward in a quiet, you know, the usual quiet sort of Japanese way, but they're going to beef up their own space assets. And I wouldn't be surprised that we're going to see some sort of talk between Russia and China and Japan about space cooperation too. And it's all part of this. It's all part of this game that we're going to see the BRICS nations building in some financial clearing redundancy.
Well, it's a little bit like watching Caddyshack. You see, you see the BRICS jumping. You know, the BRICS gopher keeps, you know, popping up with another step at building flow around the United States, and then the United States comes and, you know, whacks its golf stick on the, you know, trying to, dominate the flow. It's been, and you and I talked about this. The thing that always astonishes me about this whole process is, if you're the United States and you're the big sort of police guy on the block, and you've got the most military and you've got the most space assets. I mean, if you look at, to a certain extent, if you look at our resources versus everybody else, it's in a lot of the different statistics, there's significant divergence. You would think that you would try and be subtle about it. You would try and be gracious about it.
Right.
And I can't, you know, the thing I've never been able to figure out, why the arrogance?
Well, we talked about that yesterday, and it led us into some strange areas, and let's talk about this in connection with the idea that part of the deep agenda on the part of Mr. Global, as you like to call it, is not only building redundancy into the system, but let's look at why you would do that. Ultimately, the reason that you would do that is a military one. With international clearing right now being so narrowly based on SWIFT and CHIPS and American resources, it would be very easy from a military point of view for any, let's say, external threat to target those assets.
Right.
In other words, you need, just for simple strategic purposes, you need to build some redundancy into the system that's not under the control of just one or two players. So
right.
I think this is also part of the thinking of the BRICS nations. Russia in particular thinks in strategic long-term senses. The other thing that we have to look at is the possibility, when you ask about the arrogance that America has displayed in the last year or two. I think we discussed a very peculiar scenario. And from where I sit, Catherine, just looking at the long-term history of the way things have developed since World War II, and more particularly the establishment of the Atlantic Alliance system, the establishment of all these networked methods of international clearing, SWIFT, BIS, and so on. We've behaved in the last year, Catherine, in a sense that just has me mystified for the same reasons that it has you. And that is, we're just behaving in a very counterintuitive way on the geopolitical field. We've managed to alienate some very, very powerful allies. France has been wavering on the sanctions. Germany has expressed its extreme displeasure at our international surveillance methods. So we're going, it looks like to me that this arrogance has gone out of its way to make enemies. And then we add
right.
to that the Ukrainian picture. You know, there's no real reason for us to alienate Russia. Russia is not a threat. They have not been making any threatening moves. We're playing around in their geopolitical backyard. There's a GMO aspect to that story that most people don't know about. But what's going on here? And the scenario that I entertain in the back of my head, and I want to make sure that your listeners understand that what I'm about to say and what we discussed yesterday is really high-octane speculation.
I even wrote in the blog post that we were going to engage in, as you said, high-octane speculation.
Well, you know, I look at this and I'm trying to rationalize the behavior of America. Why are we doing this arrogance? And I just cannot get rid of the gut intuition that the United States leaders are being handed scenarios and briefs that have been gamed out on supercomputers. And the computers are telling them, do this, do that, in response to this and that, and so on and so forth. And they are, as a result, they're not thinking clearly. They're following instructions, rather like the machines that they're reliant upon. And for the life of me, Catherine, I sometimes get the feeling when you add this together with the massive surveillance, when you add it with the flash crash of 2010, which to me is still an extremely suspicious event. It's as if someone invaded the network or the network came alive on its own and has been gaming out all of these things and giving our leaders very, very bad advice from the standpoint of American geopolitics, but perhaps
right.
very good advice from the standpoint of a machine network that might have woken up or been invaded or taken over by some external entity. This is the only thing that it has me very, very concerned. And let's put ourselves in the position of the people in Beijing or Moscow for a moment, or for that matter, Berlin or Brasilia. If you're looking at American behavior and you're looking at this huge, as you call it, ultimate insider trading mechanism that all of this electronic and computer surveillance capability gives the United States, if you're looking at that and you're looking at American moves on the geopolitical stage, at some point it may have crossed the thought of your analysts in Moscow and Beijing that maybe the Americans have lost control somehow of this network and they're simply following a playbook. And that may be another pressure that is acting in a hidden sense on why the BRICS nations are so keen to develop their own international financial clearing mechanisms. They may have come to the conclusion from their own national security standpoint that the Western system has been co-opted somehow by somebody in some fashion.
Well, I'll give you sort of a line on this, a beat on this, because I lived with this, I saw it. I worked for a cabinet secretary and a couple people who worked with him who literally would have these psychotic episodes and the group would go mad together. And they would propose doing things that were certified, not only were they legal, but they were political insanity. You know, they just made no sense. And they were very much like the neocons, you know, and you would think these guys were nuts. It was really funny. I got a call one day from the White House and, you know, they said to me, you know, have you seen, we're hearing rumors of this, the secretary you work for having psychotic episodes. Have you seen this yet? And I hadn't at that point. And I said, no, I haven't. And, you know, then it was a week later that I got a taste of it. And, and it's, you know, you have to be in the room with it. And what was so amazing was most people would go along with them. I wouldn't. There were a couple others who wouldn't. But it was very interesting to see who would keep their head. And you thought you were dealing with interdimensional forces. You know, you thought you were dealing with something really bizarre. And when you, there's a, Charlie Ferguson made a wonderful documentary about the occupation in Iraq. And you saw that same force go to work. And what was interesting is he was interviewing all these council and foreign relations type who were saying, these guys are crazy. You know, because it was this neocon craziness. And it's almost, you're not dealing with a human intelligence. You're dealing with something that's nuts. They kind of think, well, the way you make something over is you destroy it first.
Yeah.
And then you build it up in your own image. And the problem is not just that they're nuts or they're destructive, it's that they're just intergalactically stupid.
Yeah.
You know, if I was going to destroy a place and take it over, I can think of so many more effective ways to do it and get away with it. You know, sorry, go ahead.
There are other indicators here to me that this may be a scenario that we have to entertain or at least think about. And that is, if you look at your experience in the federal government with that particular secretary and the psychotic episodes, and if you look at what's been happening now with this crazy arrogance and counterintuitive geopolitics, you'll notice that it's coming from sources that would have access to the gamed out computer scenarios that, you know, the Pentagon would run or FinCEN for that matter would run or the NSA and so on. In other words, it's coming from people that at some point are connected into that huge interlocked computer network.
Right.
And then if you look at statements recently in the last year, Henry Kissinger has made a couple of statements, very provocative statements, criticizing American foreign policy, particularly with respect to the Ukraine. And that's an interesting thing because Kissinger currently, as far as we know, doesn't have access to those networks. In other words, he's no longer in the loop, so to speak. So we're seeing a little bit of information clues that perhaps we have to look at that scenario. This is about the only thing that I can think of that makes any sort of sense. And it's like you say, and I think it's a very apt observation, it's almost as if we're not dealing with a human intelligence.
Right.
You look at the political leadership in Russia and so on, and their leaders seem to be far more interested in human things, in human culture, in human institutions. And American policy seems to be absolutely counter to that. So, yeah, I think we have to look at this scenario.
Well, you know, it's very interesting because when I was in Washington or on Wall Street, you would see situations where someone who really wasn't trained or ready for it would get a little bit of power. And it was very much like the Lord of the Rings. They got the ring and they'd lose their mind.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think, you know, we went through a process for 20 years where, you know, we succeeded bringing down the Soviet Union. And as I told you before, we got blinded by the beauty of our weapons. And it's kind of like we lost our minds over it. And during that period, the sycophants and the nuts rose.
Yeah.
And as a result, we've ended up with a culture. And I should say these people were very domestically violent. If you disagreed with them or didn't do what you want, you know, they would arrange for you to be framed. They would arrange for you to be assassinated. These are mobsters.
Yes.
So you've ended up with a group of people who were highly effective at taking control of the nuts and bolts of government, but they're not competent to run a global system without, you know, infuriating everybody.
Yeah.
And so it's a military question. Do they have the force to force it or not? And I say, looking around the world, I don't think so, because
right.
I don't think Snowden and Putin would be getting the help they're getting if they had it locked up.
No, I totally agree. I think they've put the United States in a tremendously overextended situation. I the way I look at it, we talked about the culture, and over time, this is the way I kind of rationalize the behavior of these financial and political elites, is this is a process that began way back in the 19th century when you had the major finance capitalists and industrialists in this country begin to wed their philosophy to what we would call progressive education, you know, the theories of Wundt and John Dewey and people like this. And they would send their own kids to these experimental progressive schools to the point that you would get the Rockefellers, Nelson Aldrich and Lawrence Rockefeller in particular, not so much David, but you had those two going to these schools and later complaining that reading was a chore for them. They didn't like to read. It was difficult for them to do. Well, over time, if you surround yourself by your own yes men, then you become incapable of thinking out of the box. And over time, the elite becomes progressively more incompetent. I think that's in part what we're looking at. And the other thing, like you say, is I think we are overextended. This is, I think, the reasoning behind these base closures that the United States has gone through in the past year. I think we're going to see more of them in Western Europe. Some of these bases closing down, they're going to shift those bases eastward, some of them into Germany, some of them more into Eastern Europe. I think this is all part of a very risky geopolitical plan, because we've managed to alienate Europe drastically since 9/11. And the scheme here, I think, Catherine, is that they're doing this for a twofold reason. Number one, they're trying to play to Western European popular opinion to get American bases out. This has always been one of the huge cries, you know, since the formation of NATO. The other reason is they're shifting eastward, both as a buffer against Russia and as a means of interdicting those Russian energy supplies into Western Europe. It's a very, very risky strategy, because even though it would allow them to interdict those energy supplies much more readily if Western Europe decides to go its own way, it also sandwiches those bases between Russia and Western Europe, which is, think Poland writ large, you know, Poland 1939, and you get the picture. But it's a very, very risky strategy. But again, to me, it's an indicator of how vastly overextended we are.
Right.
And this is gonna continue, I think, in 2015. We put pressure on Shinzo Abe to raise the constitutional level of how much of the Japanese GDP can be spent on armaments, which he has done. I think, again, that's a signal that we're overextended. A rearmed Japan, is this something that we really want? It's a very, very risky strategy. All of this is telling me that they're very overextended. And the other thing that you and I have talked about that kind of makes me think that you're right here is that if you look at our thesis of a breakaway civilization, what this may also be an indicator is that this group in power right now in the West, particularly in this country and Canada and Great Britain and so on, this group in power really does not have those old connections to that hidden infrastructure of secret projects and so on. So their balance sheet is not showing them the same thing that it shows us.
Right.
They're reliant on conventional forces and so on and so forth, and they are drastically overextended.
Right.
The other indicator, I think, that we have to mention here in this respect is that last month, the German foreign minister, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, gave a talk to a group of German industrialists at some hotel, I forget which it was, in Berlin. And if memory serves me correctly, this motel was the same motel, or pardon me, hotel, that was used by the Himmlerkreis during, prior to World War II and then during the war, to have meetings with the major industrialists inside of Germany that were backing Hitler. Well, Steinmeier addresses this group of industrialists in Berlin last month, and or it may have been November, but he came out and said, just very bluntly and directly, that it was necessary for Germany now to really think very seriously about backing up its foreign policy by military means on a global scale. And he minced no words about this. And to me, that's another indicator that Germany recognizes, number one, that the United States is overextended, that it's not going to be looking after German trade interests on a global scale. So it's necessary for Germany to step up the plate and do that. When you have someone in that position saying those types of things, this is to me yet another indicator that, like you say, our arrogant foreign policy is counterintuitive, it's out of control, it's alienating our allies. So 2015, I think, look at the BRICS nations, look at Japan very carefully, continue to watch Germany and what they do, because we're seeing all the indicators that whatever is in process, they mean to be players at the table in the reconstruction of a new global financial system, absolutely.
Right. It's when I was in the 90s, I was instrumental in lobbying the government to make Section 8 subsidy eligible to do computer learning centers in buildings. Right. Because we knew welfare reform was coming. And so I was trying to encourage people, look, in Section 8 programs, you're not allowed to start a business in your home. Can you imagine? So anybody on the housing subsidy can't start a business in their home. So anyway, so we were trying to get them to start these neighborhood network computer learning centers so people could get the skills, start a business, do all of that before welfare hit. And the big property managers would come into Washington and say, look, these people are stupid and hopeless. This is a complete waste of time. You need to give us complete subsidy because they're completely dependent. And then you'd go out in the field and the property managers would be running around slapping together these computer learning centers as fast as they could, saying, these people have skills. They can learn, no problem. Right. So they're saying, it's like two sides of the coin. They're saying black this way and they're saying white, zero or one, depending on who you're talking to, because they wanted to optimize the situation whichever way it went. And I think it's the same with America. They're running around trying to dominate the flow wherever they can. But if you look at what we're doing with internal transportation, if you look at what we're doing with oil and gas, if you look at what we're doing with energy and transportation, we're getting ready to back, to completely pull back into the Anglo-American alliance when the unraveling occurs.
Yes. Yeah. I think that has been probably the most interesting development. And you made that prediction, if I recall correctly, a couple of years ago. And I was...
No. I'll tell you what happened. I was trying to figure out. I was sitting in your office and I was saying, Joseph, I'm seeing this, this, this. And you're saying, I'm seeing this, this, this. And you and I looked at each other and we said, oh my God, they're pulling in.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
Yeah, I do remember that. This is something I think we're going to see continue in 2015. They are retrenching as fast as they can.
Yep.
And that to me is another indicator that they realize that over the long term, they're not going to be able to keep this post-war international alliance system intact. And again, the key indicators there are not just Germany and Japan, but this last month we saw President Hollande of France making noises about recognizing Palestine. Then he made the significant statement that the sanctions against Russia weren't necessarily a very good thing either for Europe or for France. And then we had the shooting in Paris, which I think was a message to Monsieur Hollande to quiet down and pull back from that position. But I really think that when he did that,
did you realize that we had no one at the
at the
ceremony?
Exactly. Yeah.
No one.
Everybody else did. Yeah. Yeah.
What I was told today, I didn't see it myself, was when asked why they didn't have, I mean, the ambassador was there, but why they didn't have, you know, the vice president or any senior dignitary. Apparently the White House said, we erred.
Oh, my.
I know.
Oh, my. That's quite a statement. If that's true, that's quite a statement. That's quite a statement. Because what you had there with that rally, really, if you look at it in a certain way, Russia sent Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, and Miss Merkel was there, Cameron was there, if I recall. You basically had a Europe-wide movement there represented.
Right.
And the non-participation of America, that's very, very significant. It's another indicator to me, and I think we talked about this yesterday, that Hollande was probably the spokesman there for some trans-European interests as far as Russian sanctions goes. And I told you yesterday, and I still think this, that Hollande was really kind of Merkel's mouthpiece on that score.
Right.
You know, France has its own reasons for wanting to see an end to those Russian sanctions, but I think he's echoing sentiments pretty much in Berlin as well.
You know, it's interesting. One of the things I concluded was, because when I looked through the money maps, and I just want to let everybody know, if you haven't looked at the annual wrap-up, it's in 10 different parts, but the second part is money maps, which is an overview of the sort of core natural resource and population and economic statistics for 14 of the BRIC nations. And one of the things I realized was, you know, the whole economy globally has developed around this, you know, so-called free trade model. And as it unravels, you know, you go from the disadvantages of having to deal with the United States or deal with U.S. currency. But if you end up with warlords and toll booths all over the world,
yep,
the ones with the big export are really in trouble. And if you look at the Anglo-American alliance, they're not in as bad a situation as you would think.
Right. Yeah, we're not nearly as export-driven. And it's that context precisely, Catherine, that really made me sit up and take notice of Herr Steinmeier's speech in that Berlin hotel to the German industrials, calling for a much more militaristic German foreign policy. That's a huge, huge admission on their part, that they realize the United States is not going to be protecting the German economy, which is, as we both know, is hugely export-driven, and a lot of
right.
It is driven with trade with the BRICS and nations. So in other words, and I've been saying this for the last year or two, that the economic interests of Germany in particular within the EU are very directly tied to Russia and to Asia. And ultimately, that's going to be a geopolitical magnet. And then you add France into that picture, you've got rather a similar thing. There's been noises about Greece pulling out of the EU. If that happens, you can bet your bottom dollar that the Russians are going to step in there very, very quickly. So this whole thing, 2015, I think, is going to be another push on the European Union to begin not so much severing ties with the West and with the United States, but drastically curtailing their blank check support that we've been seeing them give more or less ever since 9/11. I think we're going to see some huge attitude readjustment, particularly in France, particularly in Germany, and Italy is another country to watch very, very closely.
Right.
In that respect. I think you're going to see the same thing in Italy.
It's funny, during the, it's one place in the annual wrap up I wrote, you know, no matter how bad your year was, it could have been worse. You could have run visa for the Russian territory.
Yep. That's right.
I'm sure the guys who run MasterCard and Visa are very friendly now and
sure
sitting in their bunker in Moscow.
Yeah, I'm sure Mr. Putin has made them see reasons.
Well, you know, the quote of the year, I didn't use it in the wrap-up. Dave Cullum had it in his wrap-up, which is a very good. He's a professor at Cornell who does these great wrap-ups. He had a quote from Putin that I just I rolled my eyes. He said, Putin apparently said this, if Dave used it, it's true. He said, negotiating with Obama is like negotiating with a pigeon. It struts around it's like playing chess with a pigeon. It struts around the board, shits on the board, knocks over the players, and then starts talking like it won. Whew, I thought that's very strong.
Well, it's very strong and it's very true. It goes back to your observation about the arrogance of America, particularly in the last couple of years. And I don't think we're going to see that change very much in 2015. But the thing that's going to come out of it is, if it doesn't change, it's only going to push all of these fractures and fissures within the alliance system and the economic system even further apart. So it's going to be a very interesting year.
Yeah, it is. Well, one of the sections is stories and trends. The sort of the big themes in the wrap-up were the rebalance in the global economy, when that included the unraveling. But then I talk about the extent to the development of the equity markets are pulling together. There's a big section called Planet Equity. And what's remarkable is, both looking at the rebalancing and the Planet Equity, I realized, you know, these things are going to happen no matter, you know, who's in charge. So,
right.
You know, we're talking about, it's almost as though we're talking about which vice presidents are going to get promoted. But if you look at how the system is gathering, that's happening one way or the other. And then, of course, was the sort of building out of the global currency. But I then went in and did a series of, in addition to the sort of big story, which is Planet Equity and the development of the equity markets, I sat down and went through all the stories we covered in 2014 and said, okay, what are the most important stories here, and what are the deeper trends that are really going to be with us in 2015? And there are two stories I wanted to make sure that you and I had a chance to discuss. One of them, the story was the Ebola shriek meter, which, as you know, really got under my skin in 2014, big time. And the trend that represented was the uncivil society. And I thought one of the most brilliant insights I heard this year was when you talked in the fall about, you know, I don't think we can save the system. What we need to focus on is saving the culture. We've got to save Western civilization. We got to think about that. And I think that was such an important insight because, you know, as I watched the uncivil society get progressively less civil, I started to really worry about losing Western civilization.
Yeah.
So maybe if we could talk a little bit about uncivil society and what your thoughts are on that, because I think this gets right to the heart of what we can all do.
Well, I've been saying for a couple of years, particularly to the members on my website, that the system is now running counter to the basic virtues and institutions of Western civilization, at the core of which is the idea of personal sovereignty, personal liberty, and rule of law. And the system that we see being erected, particularly in this country, in the educational system over the past century, the latest gimmick coming down the pike, of course, is Common Core and all of that. But if you look at it, what they are doing is reinforcing more and more all the time the idea of the group, of the collective, of the collectivist mentality, if I can use Ayn Rand's expression. And we see a similar cynicism, and we've seen it growing, really, since 9/11, the cynicism over politics. People go out in droves and they vote and nothing changes. We're already seeing a great deal of caving on the part of Republicans in Congress on a number of things that I find are very disturbing. But I've told people over and over that it is now up to each one of us as individuals, to the extent that we are able, to embody and incarnate, if you will, in our personal lives, and then to pass down all of the major hallmarks of Western culture. And that sounds like a tall order, and it is. And I mean by that, quite literally, that each individual now is responsible for knowing and handing down everybody from Plato to Monteverdi to the Beatles to Goethe, and all of the monuments of Western culture. And the way that we have to embody it, I think, the first primary thing that we have to do is we have to own the language. We have to quit speaking in the easy terminology that has been forced into the public consciousness. We speak all the time, not of virtues like courage or individual creativity and responsibility, but we speak of values. And there's an implicit philosophy behind the term values as opposed to virtues. Behind the term values is the idea that there is no standard, there is no canon. It's merely a social convenience that people agree upon. Other changes in our language, in the corporate world, we saw the change from the Department of Personnel to the Department of Human Resources and so on. And to give you an example of what I mean by owning the language, I went in one day in a place where I used to work back when I was in the casino business, and I asked somebody, where can I find the Office of Personnel? And she said, oh, you mean human resources. And I said, no. I said, I'm not a resource. I'm a person. And the lady just looked at me, and she thought for a moment, and then she smiled. And she said, oh. She said, well, it's down the hall and so on. Well, this is what I mean. We have to start taking back the culture. And the easiest way to begin is to start taking back the language and combating the kind of reductionist, materialist cosmology that we see exemplified in everyday speech in terms like human resources, in terms like values, and so on. We have to start talking about virtue again. We have to start talking about personal responsibility and creativity. In other words, we have to buck the trend to ever greater collectivization. And the thing that this will do, and it's an interesting experiment to try. The thing that this will do is it will begin to show you, as you become conscious of the way you use language and the terms that you use, it will begin to show you and open up ever more and more and make present to the mind how all of these things are being manipulated and driven in the culture. And slowly it will spread. It will slowly spread. But that's basically what I mean by owning the culture. We are now individually responsible for handing down, to the degree that we are able, all of the monuments and good institutions. The other thing it means is that we are going to have to critique the memes that have been used to manipulate us. I don't know how else to put it. For Americans, it's going to mean you're going to have to delve into the history of the Constitution. You're going to have to read Federalist Papers. And I am insistent that when people understand what's going on, that they also read the Anti-Federalist Papers. This will give people a huge clue on the role of money behind the current Constitution as opposed to the previous constitutional system and what the debate was really all about. And you could say similar things about other nations in the West. It's something that we're all going to have to do, like it or not, to the point that those of us with children, I think we're even going to have to educate privately and in an informal way against the system, because the system is
right.
designed to collect
it, destroy them,
people, to make
right.
them passive and sheep and so on and so forth. So it's a huge task in front of us, but the way to start is to look at the language.
A couple of comments. First of all, one of my favorite examples is, you know, I spent a lot of time in the late 90s and early 2000s pointing out that $4 trillion was going missing from the federal government.
Yep.
And one of the few good offices in the federal government had been the General Accounting Office. And right as the money was flying out the door and not coming back, they changed the name from the General Accounting Office to the General Accountability Office. I thought that was really, I said, yep. Now we're really in trouble.
Yep.
And another story I wanted to tell that you inspired me to remember, I was sitting in my, at Hamilton, and I think it was about 1995, 96, and I was talking with a lawyer and some of the senior executives in the company, and they were saying, look, you just can't use words like this. We can't talk about what's right and wrong in character. You can't mention God. That's not okay. And I said, yes, it is okay.
Yes,
this is my company. That's why I started my own company, so we could talk about those things. And what you need to know is when you are operating financial systems at a high enough level, it's all about what you decide has meaning and what's important. It optimizes around, you know, virtues or
yes.
whatever. It doesn't optimize. You know, it all comes down to, you know, why are we here and what's important, what has meaning, and, you know, and these are all human choices. That's what Putin is really a master at understanding and communicating.
Yes.
And it's amazing. It's almost like, I'll tell you another story. I was very confused one day, and I turned around to one of my partners and I said, why is it? I said, you grew up on an island. Why is it so many of my partners grew up on islands? And he said, when you live on an island, you see how the whole thing works.
Yep.
So you understand that what goes around comes around, and you see the reverberation and the backwash from your own behavior, and you see who's successful over many decades because you see their behavior and their investment of time translate into all good things. So you understand how things work as a whole system. And he said, America's so big, nobody here sees the thing whole. And the government money covers up, you know, what remnants you might get despite its size. And he said, everybody's here doesn't understand what the ramifications of their behavior is. It's quite remarkable. He said, because it's just a big island, but they don't know.
Yep. You cannot. The reason that this is so vitally important is, you know, we both know you cannot have a workable financial system where there is no rule of law, where there is no virtuous behavior, where there is no honesty and morality. And this is precisely what is crippling the West right now in its
right.
attempts to move on the geopolitical field, is that it has basically legitimized psychopathic and criminal behavior on the part of financial elites. It's basically legitimized that kind of behavior geopolitically, and it's not playing in the rest of the world, and it won't play. You can't have a stable financial system or economy where the idea of individual liberty and responsibility and virtue are out the window and replaced by something called values that, oh, well, this is expedient, you know, we can, you know, it's just not workable. So there's a practice.
Well, you know,
because
of my day job, I spend a fair amount of time tracking the popular business or the official mouthpieces of the Anglo-American Alliance. And in the last month, The Economist had a beautifully, as they always do, beautifully written editorial just excoriating the U.S. enforcement system for destroying the economy by destroying the very trust that an economy depends on. I couldn't
right,
believe it.
Exactly.
And then there was an editorial in the Wall Street Journal, again beautifully written, about insane psychopathic prosecutorial abuse at the Department of Justice that was going to destroy the whole country. And I looked at both of them and I said, well, I guess apparently now they're doing it to you too.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Yeah, so it's almost as though, and then of course you have the head of the CFR writing about the neocons, and he, you know, he sounds like all the grumpy guys on the internet saying, you know, America's horrible, it's going to fall down. And you think, what in the world is going on? Because apparently it's just, the whole thing has gotten so out of hand that even these guys are you know, maybe they're just appealing to the crowd, I don't know. But it does seem to have reached a state of chaos that is truly over the top. Yeah.
Yeah, and this is the other reason it's so important. When you get to this point of corruption and psychopathic behavior on the part of leadership, there's only really ever three solutions. Number one, you have some sort of cultural renaissance or rebirth. You mentioned that when we talked yesterday. Or you have some sort of revolution, or you have some sort of tyranny to impose order. And again, the tyranny solution is never a lasting solution, because you cannot impose an artificial order simply by rule of force. It has to come from within the individual human heart. It has to come from within the individual person. And it has to be a cultural phenomenon. In other words, this again is why I think it's so vital that people understand that we're no longer passive players. We must now all consciously, in whatever sphere or whatever arena we're in, take back the culture. That means taking back the language. That means talking about things that people say you shouldn't talk about, like virtue or God or morality or what have you. It's vitally important, because if we don't do that, the financial system will collapse.
Right.
If we don't do that, society will collapse. If we don't do that, education will continue to be the murky mess that it is. So we're all responsible. There's just no two ways.
Well, education is worse than a murky mess, because I'll just talk as a business person. If kids in Outer Mongolia can go into the internet and with a great teacher for very low cost become, you know, get the very best curriculum and the very best education rather quickly, and our kids in the West have to spend 25,000 hours paying off student debt and suffering through Common Core, they're toast.
Yep.
They have not a chance. They're dead from the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, you're right on, Catherine, and I can't agree more. I've been, Dr. DeHart and I have been investigating Common Core and all of that and the effects, and this is exactly what's going to happen. We cannot afford these big $100,000 per year tuition universities.
Right.
To train people, and that's the other thing we've got to get out of our heads, is higher education isn't about training, it's about higher education. It's about familiarizing yourself at a deep and profound level with Western culture and civilization and how it works. It's not a license to go have a particular job. And this has been, you know, my personal bandwagon for a number of years. I used to tell my students or ask them, why are you here? And many of them would say, well, to get a degree. And my response was, no, you can go down the street to the Masonic Lodge and get a degree. it'll be a lot cheaper and a lot more fun, you know. So.
I can't remember who it was it might have been the Wall Street Journal. I was on one of the top business papers, and they had books of the year, and they were doing video interviews of their book editors, and it was on the fiction side, so it wasn't their business books, it was fiction. And so they had this one lovely, clearly a guy who, you know, majored in English or something, but who's a very liberal arts fellow. And he interviewed a series of books that all sounded absolutely wonderful. I got one of them, and they were all by foreign authors.
Yep.
And finally, the woman interviewing him said, why is everybody that you're recommending foreign? And he stopped. He hadn't been thinking about it. And he said, well, you know, all the Americans, they go to the same college and they write the same thing, and it's the same software program, and you know, it's really, there's no real there.
Well, This is part of that collectivization and homogenization right. that has been taking place for the last 100 years, and this is why I say, and I think you're absolutely right, you know, our educational system simply isn't going to be able to compete. And this is why people are now responsible, especially, you know, if you have children or you have friends with children that you have influence over or with, and you have to be able to hand down the hallmarks of Western culture. And again, I have to put it very bluntly. This means that each individual listening to this show is now responsible for handing down everything from Plato to Monteverdi to the Beatles.
Yeah, start buying books.
Yeah, start buying books, start reading, listen to the music. You know, we're at the stage that this is not going to be done by the system. And the only thing that's going to correct the system is to show, pardon me, to show it up for the massive shortcomings that are now systemically inbuilt into it. There's no other way, and quite frankly, it is a subversive act in and of itself if you stop and think about what I'm saying.
Well, I have to tell you a very hopeful story. This made a huge difference to me. I was, believe it or not, I was getting dental surgery. And the fellow doing the dental surgeon was a very respectable, talented, you know, sort of alpha male, you know, I mean, you know, very Southern, you know, clearly very successful Southern guy, you know, very, and you would have thought the pillar of the community. And he was livid about Common Core. He'd just gone to the PTA meeting and he, you know, and apparently his mother had been a teacher and he'd been a math teacher. He's very scientifically oriented and he'd been a math teacher and he saw the presentation on the curriculum and he went nuts. Apparently he lives in a school district. You know, he made great effort to make sure he was in a great school district with great schools and he went nuts because he, you know, and I said to him, look, don't worry, when you drive across the bridge and the bridge falls down, at least you will know that the engineers who made the bridge had a nice collaborative experience.
Yes, exactly.
And so I said to him, he started to say, well, I'm going to go to the beach. And I said, look, I used to work in Washington. I know a fair amount about this. Can I just give you a piece of advice? And of course, I'm saying this with my mouth and, you know, and he said, yes. And I said, okay, I'm going to tell you the bad news. I said, there's nothing you can do. Your children will have a socialization experience at school. You and your wife are responsible for educating your children nights, weekends. Yeah. And he looked at me and I said, it is entirely and completely hopeless. There is nothing you can do and there's no point. I said, you can take them out. You can homeschool them. You can take them abroad. But, you know, don't waste another minute of your time worrying about it. You know, it is time for plan B. And he looked at me and we started talking and he has all sorts of opportunities to take them abroad, as it turns out. And he said, I can do this. I said, good. And what I realized was, we used to have an expression on our team, whenever somebody was an obstacle, we just go beep, beep, and it meant we're just going around. We're not going to fight with them, just go around. And what was so positive after many, many decades of people getting angry and irate about this thing, and what I realized is, you now have the pillars of the community, the most hardworking, responsible, decent, patient people. They've given up in their hearts. They're just going to go around.
Yep.
And I'm talking now, you know, deep Tennessee and Mississippi. It's the heartland. The heartland's had it. So.
Yep. Yeah, they have. It's everywhere. You know, it's not, I hear from people not just in this country, and I'm sure you do, but from Canada, Australia, countries in Europe as well, where they're facing the same thing and people are waking up. But, you know, the crucial thing here to the waking up process is realizing that the central core of Western civilization, as it's evolved since the Renaissance, is individual liberty, responsibility, virtue, and all the things that virtue implies, you know, courage, honesty, integrity, and so on. All of these things are now absolutely vital, and it's up to each individual to do this, because the system is now co-opted, it's working against Western civilization, so people are going to have to embody it and pass it down themselves.
Right, and all year long, it's been people from around the world. It's been Modi and Jack Ma and Putin who've been lecturing us on all this stuff, and
yep.
And they look great, and we look ridiculous.
Yep, and they're right, and this is the reason
they're right.
That they have,
yeah.
Yeah, this is the reason they have such cachet in the world, is because they are articulating the values that we used to hear our leaders articulate, and they no longer are. So it's absolutely essential and vital in 2015 for people to understand that now's the time. It's no longer simply reading about it or thinking about it. We now have to embody it in our public discourse. We have to challenge the easy euphemistic terms that have been foisted on us over the last 50 years, values, human resources, so on and so forth, and start talking with another language altogether, because it's right. Cosmology that's at root here. So, yeah.
You know, we're all hoping you make a list for us of the 100 best books in 2015. books.
In a book, well, actually, I've been thinking about doing a webinar on this very topic on my own website.
Here, do it. You must do it.
And we talked about this too, you know, how
right.
do you identify the fellow traveler, so to speak? How do you do all this? I think it's time that we get down to brass tacks and start doing some practical things.
Yeah, well, I want to make sure I own all 100 books, so I need that list. So, and another reason we have to do it is because I want to go into the most gruesome of the 12 stories, which is transhumanism, which is if you don't turn uncivil society back to civil, it can get worse.
Oh, yeah.
Common Core is not the worst thing going on here. So one of the reasons, Joseph, that I chose transhumanism, and I should mention that Joseph and Dr. DeHart have a book on transhumanism, which I recommend in the stories, and you can get in all the usual places. One of the reasons I chose transhumanism is I've found that it's not on the, you know, it's not on people's, they're not as aware of it as you think they might be.
Right.
And, of course, one of the things that happened this year was Elon Musk really warning people about artificial intelligence, which, of course, dovetails with transhumanism. And I thought, perfect, that's a great story for the year and a great way to turn to everybody and say, look, you really need to look at it. John and I did a Salieri report on Kurzweil's singularity and did our best to tear it to shreds. And so we've introduced the thoughts before, but maybe you could talk a little bit about transhumanism and why it's important we understand this and how it relates to what we've just been talking about nurturing Western civilization.
Well, transhumanism is kind of the ultimate reductio of the materialist consumerist philosophy that we've been living under at least since the end of World War II, if not before. It's this idea that man is nothing but a machine, and therefore mankind can be improved by technological means. And transhumanists, and you mentioned Ray Kurzweil, I'm glad you did, because he's one of the people pushing the idea that with the advent of new technologies like genetics, robotics, nanotechnology, the information processing technology, they call them the GRIN technologies, genetics, robotics, information processing, and nanotechnology, that by the integration of these technologies with the individual, and please hear my words here, with the individual human being, that a new kind of man can be created, a new man, a new woman can be created. And you find transhumanists, Kurzweil in particular, talking about the idea of downloading your entire mental and emotional makeup onto a computer chip and then uploading it into a cloned body or so on and so forth. Or you have other transhumanists talking about computer chipping everybody so that they have a direct mind-to-computer interface. You have others talking about implanting nanobots that will repair the body cell by cell from any particular type of disease that you could wish. Now, these all sound really good, but the bottom line here to mankind, and I'll put my philosophical cards right on the table. I'm not a materialist. I've never been a materialist. I don't believe that the individual human person is a definable entity by any of its functions, emotional, intellectual, material, or otherwise. There's an element of mystery to every human person. And the reason I say that is if you look at our jurisprudence, again, as Western civilization has developed it, the person is not equivalent to all of their functions or emotional life or their memories, because our jurisprudence tells us that if we kill somebody while they're asleep, essentially unconscious when they're not doing anything other than breathing and snoring, that you've still committed a murder. We have ethical debates over unplugging people in comas and so on and so forth. All of these things are telling us that it's a deep part of human intuition and experience that we are more than just a body and a collection of memories and emotions. So transhumanism, if you look at it very carefully, is this materialist philosophy run mad. It's run amok. The idea that you can improve the individual human being by all these technological interfaces, that you create a new man. Well, you may be creating something new. There's no doubt in my mind that you are, but is it necessarily human? Do you retain your emotional volition if you're plugged into a computer, or does that simply mean that you are more homogenized than ever, that you've lost a certain amount of your free choice? There are other transhumanists, and it's interesting to note this, there are other transhumanists that view Kurzweil's singularity with horror, because what they see it leading to is precisely the eclipse of mankind and making human beings even more of a machine than our current consumerist culture has made us. So it's a huge, huge thing, Catherine. And I think your concern there is the same as mine. You cannot control these technologies if you do not have a culture of virtue in which to do so.
Right.
If we surrender our culture, if we surrender our individual responsibility, if we surrender our individual human creativity, if we surrender our individual virtue to a machine implant and so on and so forth, then literally you have created a race of slaves in the hands of a few technocrats that are able to program the slave. And this is coming down the pike, whether we like it or not. You see certain residues the penumbra of transhumanism in the Common Core curriculum and some of the ways that it's being sold. So people, it's absolutely essential that we wake up and realize that there are people that are wanting to engineer mankind with these technologies, and
Right. There's
no public debate about it, and this I find rather frightening. And in order for there to be a public debate, then people have to wake up, realize it's going on, take individual responsibility to inform themselves and begin to think about all this and to talk about it. This is the most essential thing, is to create the discourse and steer the discourse so that we're not being told that, oh, transhumanism will be wonderful for human value, but we need to steer the discourse. What will it do for human virtue? And this, if you look at it carefully, Catherine, in all of the public discussion from the transhumanists, very, very seldom, if ever, do you hear them use the word virtue. Very, very
I've seldom. Never heard them use the word.
Right.
Never.
Very seldom do you hear them use the word love, or compassion, or morality. So in other words, if you look at the language of transhumanism and what they're up to and what they want to do, what they essentially want to do is create new Soviet man or the new Übermensch, you know, the master race of someone that views themselves by dint of their powers that are granted to them by all this technology, that views themselves as being somehow above the normal norms of morality. And this, right. I find very frightening and terrible. We've got to take responsibility, especially on this issue.
Well, it's, I don't know a lot, you know, I haven't associated with a lot of the people who are interested in transhumanism and talk about it, but my impression is that it's coming from a direction in a group of people who, if you look at the other things they're doing, are very much diminishing individual power.
Yes, exactly.
So if you look at those things which make an individual powerful, whether it's in a physical sense, whether it's an electromagnetic sense, whether it's an energetic sense, whether it's a spirit, I mean, all the different ways you might want to describe it, the things that make people individually powerful, you know, they're going the other way on everything else.
Yes.
And then why would you add machinery to help make them powerful if you just went the opposite on everything else?
Yes.
Doesn't make any sense unless you're talking about adding something that's going to make it possible for that person to be manipulated and controlled from outside.
Yeah, that to me, Catherine, is ultimately what they're really up to. Is they want to do this simply because let's stop and consider their four technologies: genetics, robotics, information technology, and nanotechnology. Let's say that they have perfected each of these in such a fashion that they can inject them or somehow implant them into an individual human being. They can plant nanobots that repair cells. They can implant genetic material that tells you how to develop in a certain way, or you can have designer children. They're talking about this already. That they implant computer chips that will monitor whether you're taking your medicine, monitor your emotional state and adjust it as needed, that will download and upload your memories. Well, if you stop and think about what I'm really saying here and what they're really saying, the flip side of that coin is they could conceivably get to the point where they could eradicate certain of your memories, begin to tinker with your persona, with your public identity. They could as easily inject nanobots that would kill you as much as repair you. They could, through computer implants and electromagnetic and training technologies, control your thoughts, control your emotions, control your decisions. So in other words, yeah, I'm in total agreement with you. The ultimate aim
right.
here is not to enhance mankind, but to make him a slave and to make him a machine.
Right. And it's real and it's serious and it's coming.
Yeah.
So 2 weeks from now, we're going to have Dr. Catherine Albrecht is going to be back on the Solaria Report. She's got a new book. And it's a book for children where you walk them through the story of the Mark of the Beast and get them to sign a certificate saying they will never agree to allow themselves to be chipped. It's
right.
Pretty neat. So, yeah. So it's, you know, what she said is what we're all saying, which is somebody's going to try and do this. And you need to, you know, we need to do for that what we've so far succeeded with doing for gun ownership and a lot of other homeschooling. You know, if you look at the places where people have just balked, it's homeschooling, guns. A very interesting little story that was in the wrap-up was Gallup reports that the number of people who believe you're safer in your home if you have a gun is rising.
Yep.
So whatever their marketing campaign is, it's not working.
Well, yeah, and this is, and you're so right. Transhumanism has a big marketing campaign right now.
It's and unbelievable.
It is.
It's really unbelievable. And I couldn't believe that they could make this stuff look fashionable.
Yep.
And they are making every effort to make it fashionable. And what's interesting, I don't know if you've looked at the numbers, it's really failed. It's really, you know, so far it hasn't gone. But they have not given up.
No, they haven't. And you know, you look at Common Core from the standpoint of transhumanism, Catherine, you've got basically a system where supposedly the individual taking these computerized tests. The tests are supposedly going to be adjusted to each individual response. But
what?
Yeah, that's yes. Yeah.
This is like Google.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So in other words, the teacher is reduced to monitoring students on their computers, and it's really the computer that's instructing them and tailoring the next question depending on the student's response to the first question. So in other words, this is a huge tracking system, and it's
right.
also a huge social engineering system. And again, it's getting people accustomed to the idea of interacting with machines rather than with human beings. So again, yeah, ouch. And that's transhumanism writ large. So,
well, part of it is you're trying to get all these functions, something that you can organize and have governments do, corporations do for a profit. So I think exactly. one of the drivers behind Common Core is to make it possible for corporations to make money doing K-12 education,
sure.
which of course is nuts, but you know.
Well, yeah, it's again, if you look at the history of the corporation, it's only very recently in Western history that it's actually become a direct purveyor of education. Corporate charters back in the Middle Ages, of course, this is the farthest thing from their mind. Education
right.
was much more a social and civic thing than it was a corporate thing. And this is the other thing that I find very scary, because I have yet to find a corporate charter that actually embodies the Bill of Rights or the Magna Carta in its corporate charter. To put
don't hold your breath. Okay, so next, the next thing I wanted to talk a little bit about is every year my goal with a wrap up is to do a very major review and check in on what's going on in the fundamentals of the society and the economy. And then I use that to set my investment strategy for the year. So it's a pretty deep look. And I try and bring it down to scenarios, because I'm absolutely adamant no one can predict the future. And so I always try and use scenarios just on the theory that if you can sort of understand what may happen and the full range of what may happen and be prepared sort of mentally, emotionally, and if possible financially for each, then you're free. Then you're ready to bob and weave no matter which way it goes.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things I found is you're always surprised. So I'll give you a perfect example. At the beginning of the year, the one thing every financial person in the United States agreed on was we were entering the end of the great bull market in bonds. Well, the 20-year treasury was up 27% this year. That's not the end. That's an enormous revival. So, you know, we were all... So, you know, we're going to get surprised. Anyway, so for scenarios, last year I had said 80% slow burn, which is my dominant scenario, unfortunately. Not that I'm happy about that. I had one commentator this year talk to me about, you know, well, you love the slow burn. I said, I've despised the slow burn my whole life. I'm just trying to get everybody to understand it and despise it enough so that we can change it. Anyway, but... So this year I broke the slow burn. I said 90% chance, but I broke it into two scenarios. One is the violent and volatile slow burn, and then the other is what I called North American Renaissance.
Right.
And then I said 1% chance of a financial crisis like 2008. I think that's small. 1% chance of transformation, because I never give up hope, and then 8% chance of war or very significant environmental disaster. Anyway, but those were my picks. I would love to know what you think in terms of scenarios for the coming year.
I'm kind of on the same page. I think personally, I think we're going to see a bit of both North American Renaissance and a bit of violent activity. We discussed this when we talked yesterday, and the reason I'm thinking violent activity is, on the one hand, you have, like we've talked about earlier tonight, you have this out-of-control arrogance, this counterintuitive foreign policy that's going to continue to use the same playbook. And you mentioned earlier the Ebola Scream-O-Meter. So far as I'm concerned, that was just another bit of social engineering meme to get everybody panicked during the election, and also as a meme to inject, in the guise of humanitarian aid, inject American military power into Africa as a counterweight to China. I think we're going to see a drastic increase of that sort of thing. I hate to say it. I think you're probably going to see more episodes like what we saw in Paris occur in Europe. I think there's going to be some huge backlash in Europe against all the immigration policies. We're already seeing that with the rise of Marie Le Pen and her party in France. You're going to see that whole situation over there, I think, to continue to deteriorate somewhat. But on the other side, on the Renaissance side, I'm seeing, and I'm sure you're seeing the same thing with your website, I'm seeing more and more people realizing that the system is almost irretrievably broken. And realizing that they have to wake up and do something on an individual level about preserving the culture, preserving the civilization. I think in the long term, if that trend continues, it could have a huge impact on life in this country, not just financially, but politically. There's more and more people that are increasingly cynical with the political process, not that you can blame them, but they're realizing that as a result of nothing ever changing, really, no matter what the election result is, that something is drastically wrong. Something is terribly broken, and the way to fix it is at the individual level. So I think that's going to continue. That's certainly the longer term. It's less visible, but it's certainly going on. I think we're going to see that continue. I think more and more people are going to wake up and challenge the official memes and stories. I think we're going to see more and more people taking a hand in their own children's or their friends' children's education and so on and so forth. I think that's a trend that's not going to be
pushed. I think it's so important that we help the young people understand what's going on and what they can do about it, and just protect them from the misinformation and the disinformation.
Well, let me tell you a personal story. You mentioned my friend. I go and talk to his philosophy class. And last semester, I talked about personhood. How do you define personhood? How has it been defined? And then from there, once they realize that this is essentially an indefinable entity, it's only definable negatively, because my personal uniqueness, my Joseph P. Farrellness, is going to be different than your Catherine Austin fitness and you know, everybody else's individual personality. And we're always more than the sum total of our parts. We're more than the sum total of our mind or memory or emotions and so on. So we did this in this class, and then from there we segued to standardized testing. And over the course of that semester, as I was reading quotations from critics of standardized tests and so on, and sharing their experiences, by the end of the semester they had woken up and realized, and this was truly phenomenal, that the educational system, this is now the class consensus, that the educational system had robbed them, that they were being treated as essentially stupid people, and that their educational experience, had they had one in the 19th century, would have been far, you know, they would have been in the 8th grade reading at now a contemporary college level. And they're mad. This is the important thing. They're mad.
I can't tell you how many children I've spoken to who are furious about Common Core.
Yeah.
They're just furious about it. They're really angry.
Well, they're angry, and for a good reason. And this is to me, this is a very hopeful sign. If the younger generation perceives, even in their despair, that there's no jobs for them if they do go on to get a college education when they get out, and if they realize that the education that they're getting is way overpriced, that it's not at a genuinely collegiate level, then that means that you're building a huge body of opinion that ultimately is going to sweep all of this stuff aside.
Right.
So in other words, the other thing that it's doing is teaching people, especially young people, to question everything that any public institution says, and that's also a good thing. And I'm, for that reason, I'm very, very hopeful about it. And, you know, you mentioned the story of your dentist. I have this story.
I think
other people are telling me the exact same thing.
I just think because of the you have such a big planet with so many people not burdened with these handicaps.
Right.
That there's just no way that you're going to have, you know, a society as big as ours just sit and be made stupid and irrelevant in the face of what other people are doing. It's just, right. You know.
It's an absurd hope, and it's an absurd quest. They would literally have to impose something like a transhumanist common core system on the whole world to make it work. And unfortunately,
right.
You know, unfortunately, I don't see the Russians, you know, to the American system of educating people in mathematics.
No way.
If anything, no way. You know, the same with China, the same with India. You know, they have some terribly brilliant people, and they always have had, and it's going to continue. People always say, well, then why do they keep sending their students to America to get educated? Well, yeah, that's because they're living, you know, America is like the British Empire at the turn of the 20th century. It's living off the husk, and it can't continue to do that forever. And we're living off the husk right now. This is, again, why it's so vital for everybody to understand you now as individuals are responsible for learning the Western canon and handing it down. And that doesn't mean a slavish handing down. It means you do your own critique of it. You know, you interact with it on your individual level, that you learn those aspects of it that you're passionate about, be it music or literature or what have you, and hand that down. But the system isn't going to do it. The system is not going to do it. In fact, it's so beholden now to corporate and elitist interests that they cannot do anything other than mirror themselves in the system. They have boxed themselves into their own corner.
Right. I'll never forget the scariest thing that has happened to me in the last 10 years, or one of the scariest, when the financial crisis hit, which I knew it would, I knew that they couldn't let AIG go down.
Yep.
Because I understood exactly what AIG did within the black budget. And I understood that you could never take that company down.
Yep.
Certainly not. You couldn't do to AIG what you did to Lehman. And yet Hank Paulson, Secretary of the Treasury, former chairman of Goldman Sachs, did not know that. And I thought, you know, these guys are so in their little cubicle
yep.
that Hank Paulson doesn't know this. And that is really frightening. And none of the people around him know. And the CIA isn't there soon enough to tell him.
Yep.
You realize, you know, we got a real problem here.
Yeah, the real problem, you've put your finger right on it, is the elite has become incompetent. They have surrounded themselves with their own yes men for so long they can't think in any other way. And they've been educated by the very system that they've foisted on others. And part of that system, and this is so crucial, you've put your finger right on it when you said cubicle, is that part of the American educational system is by its very construction, you are not taught or allowed to make interdisciplinary connections. You go to mathematics for 50
right.
minutes, and then the bell rings, and off like Pavlov's dogs, you go to English literature, where you do that for 50 minutes, and then it's off to quote-unquote physical education, whatever that is. So in other words, you are never taught to connect dots between disciplines. You can never think outside your own cubicle, and that's the problem with the elite. They can't think outside their own cubicle.
Well, but here's the thing. If you look at the players who were controlling either at a policy level or an operations level in what I now call the breakaways, or working for Mr. Global higher than the U.S. government, they were competent. They did know what they were doing, and they didn't, they never showed their face. They didn't, you know, there was no arrogance there. They were brilliant. They had incredible knowledge. They, you know, they were stealth.
Yep.
And they were smart as a whip, and they knew how to play.
Yep.
So I'm assuming they still have that capacity, and they've got yahoos in the chairs for a reason. I don't know what it is.
I part of me thinks, yeah, they still have that capacity, but the other part of me is that this system has been in place now for the better part of a century, that I begin to wonder if even in the breakaway group, that Mr. Global level, you have real competence left. You know, it's a measure of that, that you have people like Henry Kissinger, Catherine, speaking out against the current manifestations of American geopolitics and foreign policy.
Right.
Because he certainly, you know, whatever else you say about him, he certainly was capable of thinking in an interdisciplinary way and painting on a very broad canvas. But you don't see that anymore. And, again, this is the other reason I think it's so vital for everybody to realize that, that we're now responsible for the hallmarks of Western civilization, because that means we have to paint on a big canvas. And most of us, you know, in your audience and my audience, most of us are already doing that. It's now a question of how do we take this into practical action. And like I say, the first thing is own the culture, and the first part of owning the culture is owning the language.
Well, I'm going to clean up my language. There's no doubt about it. You've inspired me.
Well, same here. So, you know, we are all, you know, we've all been so
debased. We've all got been acculturated into the debasement. Now, I have two more things I need to cover with you, which are absolutely critical. One is, and you and I have been talking about this back and forth and back and forth. I both in the macroeconomic sense, and then in the micro investment economic sense, we are operating in a world where all the current financial models have no relationship with reality.
Right.
And the struggle, whether it's trying to keep the central banking warfare model going, you know, it's the BRICS have finally given up and said, look, they can't talk about new models. We will. So whether it's reinventing the planetary investment model, or, you know, I've always shared with you my incredible frustration, because I live in a world of financial people, and whenever I try and talk to them about the black budget or the hidden finance system or the mechanisms that are used to control and engineer the slow burn, they're like, excuse me, I don't want to talk about that. That's not, you know, that's not socially acceptable to talk about those things. And then they get angry when, you know, hyperinflation doesn't start. And I try and explain, well, let me explain the control mechanisms you use to do this. No, I don't want to talk about that, you know. Exactly. So we bounce around where their models don't fit reality. And, you know, and you're in this incredibly cranky negative loop. And the thing that's amazing to me, Joseph, is they are so confident in their positions, and they persuade, you know, they persuade thousands and thousands of people to believe them. And of course, you know, everything, every year, what they say is going to happen doesn't come true. And they never sit down and say, well, lessons learned, how are we wrong? So you've got this whole world of financial people who are stuck in old models.
Yes.
And one of the things I will say about 2015, I think it's going to be so painful. It's just going to blow them out of this negative loop. Now, it, you know, I don't know what that looks like or what it means, but they're going to be forced by reality to just stop, you know. So the bottom line, and this is the way I said in wrap up, you know, on one side I have people saying, oh, you can trust the establishment, just put your money in index funds, don't worry. and everybody else is saying, well, that, you know, think about it. If you're the establishment, you don't have to have them. If you put your money in an index fund, then you never look and say, well, wait a minute, I'm putting it in Monsanto, and what is Monsanto doing? You know,
yes.
So you can start to do is these, you know, more and more crazy things of if people aren't looking underneath the rug. So that's number one. Number two is, you know, the other guys are saying, you know, the establishment is to blame for everything that happened, included everything that went wrong in my life. And, you know, and don't worry, buy gold. It'll go to 8,000 this year. Mm-hmm. And so you've got two alternatives, neither of which are deeply satisfying.
No, they're not.
Right.
They're not.
Right. And so the question is, we need a pathway through, whether it's on the global scale or it's on the individual scale. We need a pathway through that starts with reality to the best of our ability to figure out what reality is.
Right.
And I just, you know, whether it's at the global level or the, you know, the local little manage your money level, we have to find a pathway based in reality that combines reality with taking personal responsibility.
Yes.
And that's what's happening. And I think 2015 is the year when that conversation at both the global and the intimate level really gets going, because everybody's going to give up on the, you know, it's like, whatever we know, this is not working.
Right. I think you're absolutely right. It's hard to predict where this might go, but let's look, since you raised what I call the standard model economic financial forecasters. If you look at them, you've got the typical debates between, you know, Keynesianists and fiscalists and Austrian school and so on. And what they're doing is they're repeating the same old dogmas that have driven their analyses for the last 100 years. And if you look at those models, at least as far as I'm concerned, I even did a blog last year called Against Economic Chicken Little. and my problem with all of that is the same as yours. They keep predicting hyperinflation, it doesn't occur, or massive deflation, and that isn't occurring. It's somewhere between the two. They keep predicting these things. But what they never, and then you've got the gold bugs, of course, and they're in there. And this is an example. This is a prime example of what I'm talking about by having the blinkers of the cubicle on.
Right.
Because let's take gold. Gold, most people don't realize, is the metal of choice for storing highly radioactive, highly processed radioisotopes like uranium-235 for A-bombs and so on and so forth. And I did a blog about a story.
Oh, it was fabulous. I reposted it on the Soleri.
On the Soleri report? Yeah.
Yeah.
This is about how gold was being taken out of nuclear weapons for reprocessing and remelting, and then, you know, God knows what they did with it. But what people have to get through their head is you cannot approach, in the nuclear scientific age, you cannot approach even the subject of gold as just a commodity in a bank somewhere. It's also a absolutely crucial commodity for the production of nuclear weapons. It's a crucial commodity for storing and transporting fissile material of weapons grade or high refinement. So in other words, part of the gold story that we may be looking at that's going on in the last decade or so, with everybody wanting their gold and no one getting it back, is there may be a hidden thing here going on relating to nuclear weapons. Well, mention that to a financial analyst and most of their eyes will glaze.
I wonder when we talked about the huge takedown, when they took the price of gold down, what should normally happen in the biggest inventory was GLD, the ETF. What should normally happen is the inventory doesn't change. The price just goes down. And as the stock price goes down, the value of the inventory goes down, but the inventory doesn't change. Well, that's not what happened. Of course, the ETF had been set up so you could swap large blocks of stock to get inventory. The inventory took a nosedive. And that's when I said to you, did they just buy the moon? Was this just a warehousing vehicle to build up? Well, one of the things I realized when I looked at your article was, if they really have been decommissioning the extent of both the U.S. and Soviet nuclear arsenal, did they do that big inventory of gold so they could decommission large amounts of nuclear weapons at one time?
Yeah, Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And the point here is I think that we're both trying to make, is that you cannot look at these types of events anymore from any sort of standard model of economics or finance that you learn in Vienna or Harvard or what have you, because it requires a genuinely interdisciplinary approach. And
mm-hmm.
the other flip side of that approach is that you then, once you've admitted that there is a nuclear component hidden within the bullion markets, silver being the other one, obviously, once you admit that, then you're going to have to say, well, then, yeah, we have to look at the huge black budget as part of the financial picture. And once we do that, then you have to admit hidden mechanisms of finance. You have to look at the international criminal drug trade, and so
right.
on and so forth. And you get a very, very different, picture than standard financial analyses once you do that. And the picture is, it's both gloomy and yet at the same time, in a certain way, not so gloomy, in that that whole mechanism is much more stable than people realize, and it's been stable since World War II. You've mentioned the Exchange Stabilization Fund on numerous occasions. I've been talking about all that Japanese gold that entered the picture, that it was kept off the books. So in other words, the basic bottom line here is that the amounts of gold in the world are obfuscated,
right.
probably as much as an order of magnitude, and they're obfuscated for several reasons. They're obfuscated because of nuclear weapons programs. They're obfuscated because some of this was part of a hidden mechanism of finance. So, you know, I think you're right. I think 2015, we're going to see if the lid doesn't blow off of all of this in 2015. I think you're going to see more and more people waking up and realizing that standard financial models simply aren't working, and therefore we've got to start examining all the assumptions very, very carefully. And if that happens, that's a good thing.
Well, the opportunity, if you could re-engineer the federal budget to simply optimize the economy,
yep.
there is the productivity that could come is just it's unbelievable. Now, let me give you some statistics. Two or three years ago, in Steve Roach's book Unbalance, which I think is just one of the best business books of the year by far, he says the American population has 4.5%, or the American population is 4.5% of the global economy. We consume 17% of the consumption. India and China combined are 40% of the global population, and they consume 4.2%.
Yep.
Okay, so you can imagine the adjustment that has to occur if we're going to come to parity, which means we better get our productivity up. Now, the only way I know to do that fast is to re-engineer the federal budget to mammothly improve economic productivity. The challenge with that is you can't re-engineer the overt part of the budget without re-engineering the covert part of the budget.
Covert part of the budget, yep, exactly.
Now, we haven't had to for one magical reason. And that magical reason, the reason we've never had to deal with the kind of personal responsibility and virtue that you've been talking about, is we had a way of keeping the system going called debt.
Yep. Yep.
And that's about up. It's, you know, I thought it was up last year, so I was wrong. Maybe it's up in 2015. Maybe it takes another 3 years. But it's up one way or the other. The steroids have almost run their course. And that means we have to get down to, you know, accountability. And
yep.
that's not anything that any of us are prepared to look at.
And
it's what I find.
Accountability. Yeah, I'm totally agreed. It's not just accountability. This is the other flip side of owning the culture and being personally responsible. Because personal responsibility in this financial context also means personal creativity.
Right.
People are going to have to be much more aware and much more savvy about the global financial picture in order to make their own localized decisions. So that's one thing that's going to happen. The other thing I think people have to start thinking about in a very major way is, to what degree can they begin to have a kind of entrepreneurial basis for their own personal finances, whatever that basis may be.
Right.
I think that's a huge part of the problem that we're facing. How do we monetize our talents? In other words,
right.
That's basically what it's coming down to. Be it, you know, whatever it is, be it music or whatever. How do I monetize it? And that's going to be, if people can figure that out, then we may see that North American Renaissance that you talked about.
I just saw a shocking statistic. Guess who's the second largest exporter of food in the world?
Who?
The Netherlands.
The Netherlands?
I couldn't believe it. Now, I can't believe they're ahead of Brazil, so I'm going to go check the statistics. This was in Wikipedia. But, you know, if the Netherlands can come up with that much food. Now, I think they're bringing it in and sending it out of their centers, too. So, well, I have to dive into the statistics. But it's a perfect example of, you know, the Dutch are a perfect example of, you know, you think you can't do something with a little bit, you're, you know, go check out the Dutch. Okay, so now I'm going to ask you the most difficult question I've ever asked you. Are you ready?
Saving it up for the end. Huh?
Yes, I'm saving it up for the end. If I said to you that all of the people listening tonight only had enough time to read 3 of your books in the next year, what would they read, you know, in order of importance? What would the 3 books be?
Oh boy,
it's hard.
That's a hard one. I think the first one would be Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, and the reason would be it's in that book that I really go into some detail about the historical origins of this hidden system of finance and what they did and how they did it and who did it. That would be the first book. The other book I would read would be Financial Vipers of Venice, for the simple reason that I explore in there how Venice was able to manipulate the bullion markets and use them as a mechanism to basically go into an economic currency warfare mode against some of their principal competitors. It's a very old story, and the playbook is very old. That would be the second one. The third one is kind of a toss-up. I would say either read the book The Nazi International or Roswell and the Reich. And the reason I mentioned those two books is simply to show people what the origins of this huge hidden black budget was and what sorts of technologies they were playing around with, because in those two books I go quite extensively into some of the technologies that were actually floating around back during the war and where they went and what happened as a result and how the national security state was set up. So those would be my picks.
Well, then they have to make time for a fourth because they have to read the transhumanism. Remember, I told them they have to get.
Oh yeah, transhumanism is another one. That's a very important one because we talked in there a great deal about all sorts of stuff, about literature. We talked about GMOs a great extent in that book and how they fit into the whole transhumanist meme. Yeah, that would be another important one.
And I, as you know, I believe they fit into the currency as well.
Oh, absolutely.
So now, is there any hope that your next book will be out in time for them if they want to read a fifth?
The next book I'm currently researching. The bad news is I've got to read 2 books in German. the publisher told me, well, you think you'd have it done by August, and that's kind of my target date, so that will be coming out. I don't want to give out what the book is about.
No, don't give away anything.
But it'll be dealing with financial and corporate matters in a major way and their interlock with current political institutions.
Okay. And then tell us how, if we want to become a member of your website, we can do it and what we get if we do.
All right. My website, it does have a members area. And in the members area, I have a few papers I do. I just started doing webinars, little monologue talks with PowerPoint presentation accompanying, and we do vid chats about once every 2 weeks where my members, and those are the most fun because it's basically like an extended conversation. People email me questions, and then I attempt, not always successfully, to answer or respond to them. And they usually last about 2 hours. You can go to my website, which is www.gizadeathstar.com, and membership subscriptions are about $12 a month. And that's basically what we do there. So that's what they can expect. Everything is archived. All of our interviews that you and I have done are archived there as well. All the vid chats are archived and so on and so forth. So there's quite a lot.
Yeah, there's incredible amount of material.
Yeah,
incredible, great material.
Philosophical things and some of the things that you and I have talked about tonight in the culture and how it came about and what some of its underpinnings are and what the implications are. So it's kind of an ongoing extended discussion.
It's sort of like a Socratic dialogue graduate symposium.
It is. It's kind of like a symposium, exactly.
You know, one of the advantages of the world being corrupt is you'd be at Oxford teaching and we couldn't get you, but because the world's corrupt, we can get you.
Yeah.
You know? That's
Well, vice versa. If the world's corrupt, you'd still be at Hamilton instead of telling the world about what's going on. So, yeah, it's a two-way street.
Anyway, okay, well, Joseph, my prediction is that, I believe it or not, I believe that people who have made an effort to get to know what's really going on and to deal with reality will, oddly enough, be in a position to have a remarkable good year. I think the question is, can we psychologically enjoy ourselves when so many people are going through such a difficult or violent period? So I think that, you know, that does make it hard. But I, when the Bola Shrieka meter was really getting under my skin, I went and studied the statistics of disease. And what I discovered was, you know, one person in 2014, I think it was one person died in America from Ebola. Is that right? Was there more than one?
Yeah.
Okay. One person died from Ebola and approximately 600,000 died from heart disease. And I realized, oh, America's dying of a broken heart.
Yes, that's right.
And that's what we need to not do. So,
yeah, I totally agree.
I think no matter, you know, for those of us who faced it, I think we have an opportunity to really make a difference this year. And so I told our little team, I said, here's our business plan for 2015. It's three words. We have fun. Because if we can have fun, then we can really keep doing what we do. So
if we have fun, we can laugh at the elites, which,
right.
You know, there's that old expression from John Donne, the devil is a proud spirit and cannot bear to be mocked. So.
Okay, well, Joseph, I can't thank you enough for joining me and taking a look at the wrap-up and for the contribution you made and helping me. It takes me, you know, I have to really chew through these things, and it really helps me to have your very clear and coherent input. It was very useful. So thank you again, and we hope you just have a fantastic year, and this new book is your best book so far. Bye.
You too. Thank you, Catherine, for having me back on.